Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Very happy to be joined today by a first-time guest. Baylis Wagner is a politics reporter for the Austin American Statesman. She's been writing extensively about some of the biggest developments in the legislature this session. And I wanted to check in with her on some of the subjects that I think she's been covering with a very keen eye. So thanks for being here, Baylis.
Thanks so much, Jim. Really happy to be here.
You don't come to campus a lot, probably, right?
Nope, not part of my beat, generally.
Not from here and not your beat.
Actually, the last time I was on Speedway, it was the protests in April. So a lot less horse manure this time.
Yeah, no horses today.
Yeah.
More comparatively boring.
Yeah. Very manicured. Looks nice.
So we're in that stage of the session where the nights are getting later. There's a lot more work to keep up with all the things that are going. So I appreciate you taking the time to be here. Let's dive in. The latest reporting you did that got my attention was a piece earlier this week on intra-party tensions in the Texas House, and I want to get to that. But before we get to that, let's start with the kind of newsier stuff. You have your latest story on the Austin American Statesman site is on the abortion front. Last night, the Senate passed SB 1880. Tell us about the bill and kind of tell us what's going on with that.
Yeah, so SB 2880 is considered the most wide-ranging abortion ban / abortion pill crackdown in the country. It's building on the mechanism that made SB 8 so novel and, successful, I guess, ahead of its time. SB 8 was a bill that allowed private citizens to sue people they suspected or people who were alleged of providing abortions illegally. And before 6 weeks at that time, now we have a near total ban. So what this does is it allows Texas private citizens or other private citizens to sue out-of-state abortion pill providers, distributors, manufacturers, prescribers, pretty much anyone who might have any hand, even people, even Venmo, PayPal, if they collect payments for those pills from Texans. It also has some, interesting provisions on jurisprudence. So a state district court is not allowed to determine that it's unconstitutional. And a judge could be fined, if they are sued, $100,000 if they block the law ahead of it going into effect. So there was a lot of discussion about both the jurisprudence aspect and the fact that it'll further restrict abortion pills, which continue to flow into Texas.
And what was the vote like on that? Because you did it. You had one Republican that didn't vote
yes.
for it. And I think Senator Nichols
yes.
was present not voting, right? I
think yeah. Right. Yeah. So it was party line. All Republicans voted for the bill. But Senator Nichols voted, abstained. I asked his office why that was. Haven't gotten a response yet. But he's kind of known as more of a moderate. Or at least he doesn't always vote with the party.
Yeah, Senator Nichols was one of the votes in favor of the Paxton impeachment, some two counts of the Paxton impeachment. I would say, I think if you ask Senator Nichols if he was a moderate, he would probably say,
he's
I'm not
moderate.
A moderate.
Yeah.
But I think he is known as somebody who is more independent-minded, particularly in the more recent versions of the Senate, dominated by Dan Patrick, where independent-mindedness has not been as much in evidence, to understate the case, I think, a little bit. So what is this looking like in the House? What's your sense of from your reporting on what the prospects for the bill are in the House?
So the bill has already gotten a hearing that happened on Friday, and it's being carried by Representative Jeff Leach, who is one of Speaker Burroughs's right-hand men. It has the support of at least 38 House Republicans. So while it's expected to face a harder road than in the Senate, where it sort of breezed through, the fact that it's already been heard will probably be voted on soon now that the Senate version is passed through. The House is expected to swap the Senate's version for its version. It could come to the floor very, very easily. And I'm not hearing about Republicans being willing to oppose it. So I think I wouldn't discount the chances that it passes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about abortion politics and this going back historically in the House is that there's a tradition for a long time of House leadership. It's kind of a term of art, quote unquote, protecting members from hard votes. And abortion often fell into that bucket until, you know, the more recent rightward shift in the House. Part of that is that public opinion is sort of divided on that among Republicans. Yeah. So we did polling in June of 2024. We asked a general question about Texas views on preventing access to abortion pills, which I think you've used before in some of your coverage. Overall, only 28% supported that ban. 62% were opposed. And interestingly, among Republicans, 41% opposed, 41% supported, 45% opposed.
Yeah. And there was, if I wrote about those numbers, I remember something like 80% believed that there should be some kind of exception for rape, incest, and fatal fetal anomalies, none of which are present in the current iteration of the law, and none of which are contemplated by Republicans in leadership right now.
Right. And so that's been kind of under the surface of this for a long time, I think, in terms of the way that this debate is unfolded and trying to figure out what's going to happen in the House, where, you know, members have been a little bit harder to wrangle and the politics of this have been more complicated. You know, and some data we're going to release next week, kind of a teaser alert, I guess. We have a few more questions about abortion. We ask our kind of standard question about whether Texans want abortion laws made more strict, less strict, leave them alone. You know, this problem is still there. 38% of Republicans want stricter laws, stricter abortion laws, which is not a majority, but too many to ignore, right? And then when you break that down and look at it by ideology, among that 38% of Republicans that want stricter laws, predominantly strong Republicans and people that identify as on the far end of the conservative scale.
That's really interesting, especially in the context of how last week there was a huge uproar from the hardline conservative bloc in the House about a bill that would have classified abortion as murder and allowed the state to go after and potentially jail or imprison women who have abortions. There's an uproar over the fact that it was pulled from a committee hearing. And leadership, including Representative Leach, have been really firm about we're not going to go after women. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has. But a lot of Republicans were in the public comments ahead of the hearing saying, we really think this should be illegal. So that's, yeah, there's a lot of room there.
Right. And I think that it's, you know, this has been an area where the rightward shift of the party, of the Republican caucus in the House in particular, is really going to become evident because they've reached a threshold. I don't know exactly what we should consider the number to be, where the conventional wisdom of a decade ago doesn't really hold in terms of the idea that people at the end of the day would rather not vote on laws like that. And I think that's probably still true of most of the Republican members. But one of the reasons that they'd rather not vote is because when they have to vote, they know what direction they have to vote on because of the primary dynamics. Let's talk about the other shoe in the abortion fight, and that is SB 31, which you've also covered extensively. Tell us about that bill and where that is.
So that was a really interesting one. So the bill was filed also by Senator. So both of these bills come from Senator Hughes, who's known as the author of SB 8, very, very anti-abortion. SB 31 comes from the premise, well, comes from reports that women have died after doctors delayed or denied abortion care when they were in really serious health conditions like experiencing sepsis or already miscarrying and losing blood. He has said this bill was designed such that, you know, hospitals and doctors have no excuse not to care for these women when they are in these life-threatening situations. So it puts a higher burden on the state and others to prove that a doctor has acted in violation of the ban. It makes clear that, you know, there are certain conditions which doctors can treat. It also says a woman doesn't need to have imminent death. You know, it can be a condition that would cause a risk of death down the line. And also has an education component. Pro-life, anti-abortion, whatever you want to say, groups were really, really supportive of it. It was interestingly opposed by some pro-abortion rights groups over a clause that would have potentially invoked an 1857 abortion ban that Texas has. So they fixed that by saying this bill doesn't revive or reject the 1857 ban, and also saying this bill can't, you know, doesn't, like, Texas will not go go after women who get abortions, just the people who help them.
But that also came up in the debate on the bill we were just talking about, and was kind of moved aside in that debate by the bill author, right?
Yes, and
as I understood it,
that was really interesting. Well, yes. Yeah, so Senator Nathan Johnson, noted that this bill explicitly gives Attorney General Ken Paxton the power to enforce the 1857 ban along with the other bans through civil lawsuits. And he said, would you consider, you know, putting a clause in there that says we're not trying to revive the 1857 ban? And Hugh said, no, this isn't that other bill. So I think, Republicans feel that this law is already active. But Hughes later vehemently denied that it would be used to go after women. He said, that's false. I don't know what you're doing with that. Maybe it's to raise money. So it's a different bill. I mean, it'll do a lot of the things that the pro-abortion rights groups were worried SB 31 would have done if it revived the 1857 law. So it's all complicated.
Well, I mean, but let's unpack that complication a little bit, because I think that's what I really wanted to go with that in terms of your reporting, because I know you've talked.
Okay.
You've been talking to a lot of different groups here. So you've done a pretty good nuanced job, I think, of, you know, pointing out these tensions that kind of came up in your comments a moment ago about the fact that on one hand, there are a lot of pro-choice groups, abortion rights groups that desperately wanted these clarifications in 31, but that coalition was very hard to keep together, it seems to me.
Yeah, it's interesting. The split was between...
Or maybe not. I guess that's what I should put that in a question, as in the form of a question.
Yeah, it seemed like... So Democrats were really big on getting these clarifications, and they've been talking about it for a long time. It's more the activists, I guess, were generally aligned with Democrats, who then found themselves on the opposite side. They said they weren't involved in the process of drafting SB 31. They were really upset about that. And so when this, you know, when they found what they said was a Trojan horse provision that would have, in their opinion, revived the 1857 law, which Republicans say it's not, you know, you don't need to revive it because it's already live. But So they were really upset about not being part of the process. And what their two concerns were, you know, because the 1857 ban, and I say 1857, people call it the 1925 law, but it is not at all a 1925 law. It was, the language goes back to 1857, but it was codified, you know, with other Texas laws in 1925. So pre-Roe law, 1857 law, those are both accurate. This law does not explicitly exempt women from being prosecuted, unlike more modern laws, though it was never, ever, ever used to do that. In fact, there's, you know, dozens of cases that say, no, this law cannot be used to go after a woman who has had an abortion. She's considered the victim. And then their other concern was that because it has a vague, sort of a vague turn of phrase, it says, it's illegal to furnish the means for an abortion. They said abortion travel funds, which pay for people to go out of state to get abortions, could be criminalized. A UT professor I talked to, Liz Sepper at the law school, said she didn't find that very convincing as a legal argument because, again, criminal laws are implicitly not applied out of state. Like, one state's criminal laws not usually applied out of state. but you never, the abortion rights groups were like, well, you never know in Texas.
We've seen a lot of boundaries broken and norms broken and former practices.
Yep. So anyway, so they fought really hard not to have Democrats vote for something that would do that in SB 31, because it said, you know, this is to help women, you know, in their health. And they were like, that shouldn't be part of it. But SB 2880 explicitly goes after out-of-state, you know, like abortion pill distributors and stuff. It does not go after travel. So it does not prohibit women from traveling out of state. It used to, but they changed it in committee, which is interesting.
What did you think that was a compromise? I mean, I read that as a compromise based on sensitivity to a possible legal challenge anyway.
Yeah, I think they felt pretty certain that wouldn't succeed. And there's an Alabama law that was to that effect that would have prohibited travel that isn't doing so great in court right now. There was a Republican, so the Texas GOP is known to be more, you know, in some ways more far right than some of the lawmakers. They tend to be the real grassroots activists. During their convention last summer, they had this whole discussion where they were like, I don't think we should even make it a priority to ban travel because that seems unconstitutional. At least one woman spoke up and said that. So,
but she didn't really carry the day, as I recall.
No, yeah. You're right. She didn't. the platform does say, you know, we'd like women not to be able to travel. But maybe I'll pull at that thread later, try to ask around.
Yeah, let's put a pin in that in that part about the Texas GOP and,
yeah, sorry,
you know, who the activists are and where the center of the party is. But that's a good segue. Thank you. So let's talk a little about these internecine GOP fights that you've been writing about. Now, your story earlier this week was kind of pegged to maybe the end of the previous
Friday,
week,
yeah.
Right? And that peg was efforts by members on the right end of the House GOP caucus to kill Democratic bills on the local and consent calendar, which then led to Democrats doing the same thing to Republican bills. But in the House was, you know, a big deal because the local and consent calendar is normally the place where things are easy. That's the whole purpose of the calendar, frankly, in a lot of ways. So talk a little bit about that story and kind of what you found out in reporting that.
Yeah, so the symbolism of the local and consent calendar going down can't be mistaken, right? It is the uncontroversial bills that were then became controversial. And I think it's indicative of a broader sort of polarization that we're seeing. There are a lot of different conflicts about this. What it really shows is that there's, you know, the House leadership, Speaker Burrows, his team, what are considered the more establishment Republicans, though, you know, in other states, that wouldn't necessarily be the label for them. They're all very conservative. But, and then there's the hardline bloc. And so the hardline bloc feels that leadership isn't doing enough to bring, you know, their priorities to the floor, and they're upset that Democrats have really any say in this chamber. What they say is that Democrats, not a single Democratic bill, no matter whether it's naming a road, helping to curb the overpopulation of deer, should hit the floor before any Republican bill. But as we know, that's not how the Texas House works. Republicans don't have a supermajority. Democrats have leverage, and they've been using it. They can block constitutional amendments from passing. They need 2/3. And they have a big say in the speaker's race. So, but I guess what it boiled down to and what I think the headline that caught people's attention was Representative Steve Toth, one of the hardliners, saying it's time, you know, Burroughs' leadership team has left us no choice but to burn it all down. So the gripe from some of the more, you know, the Republican leadership members were, you're slowing everything down, but complaining that things are going too slowly for Republican priorities to pass. And what they're saying is, well, this is what we have to do. It's total war.
And you know, you mentioned polarization as the context for this. And it's interesting to me that there's kind of two nested conflicts here. I mean, on one hand, there's the party polarization that these Republicans that are fighting the leadership at this point are using to leverage their argument, mm-hmm. right? Saying, you know, this chamber should be run, you know, I would say more like a parliamentary system than the system we have, which is we're the majority party. Everything should be our. Why are we not doing that? And you kind of implied the answer. I just want to kind of tease out a little bit. And the answer is, well, because that's not really the way this system works. And if you want it to work that way, as you say, you need a bigger majority. But the other part of this is, I think, and this, you know, I want to phrase this as a question, I suppose. I don't see that fight between the far right, dissidents and the opponents of the leadership and the leadership as solely on this kind of left-right continuum. In other words, you know, I mean, we knew going into this election that, you know, Dustin Burrow's voting record was, you know, by all accounts and fair accounts, more conservative than his main opponent, David Cook.
Yes.
Now, David Cook didn't have much of a record, so that's, you know, a different thing. So I'm wondering just how you kind of account for that, because there's a certain amount of, you know, the roots of this, and we'll, you know, it's by way of transition, are partially in the speaker, the last speaker's fight that we saw that resulted in Dade Phelan losing support for re-election and the election of Dustin Burrows. Most, if not all, of the most vocal proponents of the kinds of positions you were articulating, you mentioned Steve Toth, several others, you know, were people that were opposed to Dade Phelan and then were opposed to Dustin Burrows' speakership. So as you're covering that, I mean, you know, in certain kind of circumstances, the ideological template does a lot of work for you, I mean, in explaining things. But in others, it's a little fuzzier.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage that as you're trying to make sense of this? Or does that make sense to you? I'll just take your nod of assent. It makes sense. I'm just wondering how you kind of sort that out as you're trying to make sense of it and convey it to readers.
I think one really important dynamic is one man, Tim Dunn. I think that he can explain a little bit of this intra-party tension that isn't totally on a, you know, ideological spectrum. He is, so he's one of the biggest funders of Texas Republicans, and he is also the owner of Texas Scorecard, or his group funds Texas Scorecard, which is you might call it the propaganda arm of the Dunn movement. And it tends to be those people who are funded by Dunn and Dunn's groups and also Ferris Wilkes. Both of them are pastors. Both of them are pretty explicitly, you know, follow Christian nationalist ideology and saying, you know, Texas should be, we're a Christian nation. Our laws should reflect that.
Right.
A lot of those people tend to be aligned and they tend to have views, for example, that the Texas Ethics Commission is totally corrupt.
Right.
Where does that come from? Look at how Michael Quinn Sullivan, the head of Texas Scorecard, was fined by the Ethics Commission for not registering as a lobbyist, sued, is still in a legal battle. I guess sometimes I see that as being part of the dynamic. There's also a sort of a new guard, old guard. A lot of these members are newer. One or two sessions, for example. Briscoe Cain, he's one of the more senior members, but he's still not, you know, a super longstanding member, who see... I guess some of their critics would say they just don't understand how things work. They're just too new. They don't see why it's important to bring Democrats into the conversation every once in a while. But they're also sort of a burn it all down Trump style. There's another dynamic with Trump. I guess, how would you explain it? That's sort of, those are some of the things I think about.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was an honest question in the sense that I think a lot goes into that. You know, I mean, I think the Tim Dunn, you know, whatever they're called now, Empower Texans.
Yeah,
you know,
Texans United.
Yeah, there are various, you know, they've
rebranded.
They rebrand and relabel for lots of reasons, I think. But, you know, I mean, I think that's all part of it. I mean, I think that, like I said, honest question in terms of how you manage it. I mean, I think that there's a different theory of institutions among these newer members that I think they are bringing to bear.
Yeah.
But I think it's a difficult question to answer because on one hand, you know, somebody would fairly object to my characterization of that as saying, well, look, if you're going to look at the voting records of those, you know, the opponents to the Burrows speakership, they do cluster on the far right end of any kind of fair voting analysis. But I think you do have to step back and see that the range we're talking about ideologically, as you kind of implied earlier, is pretty narrow.
Yeah.
In other words, yes, you might be able to sort of come up with an explanation for why some of these guys are more conservative than the others, but that's not making the others moderates by any means in most circumstances.
Yeah. But they do cluster on the far. I mean, some of the things it's a lot of like vaccine related things, abortion related things. But yeah, not all of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. It's almost about, you know, agenda more than, you know, in some cases, you know, where they really want to spend time as opposed to whether everybody's positions, if you could somehow sum them up.
Or, yeah, and if I could segue, I mean, I think this, I know we're planning to talk about this exchange between Representative Brian Harrison and Representative Jeff Leach. I think that this dichotomy was sort of on full view. Harrison was presenting a bill that would have allowed for lawsuits against, allowed the state to kind of go and enforce a ban on environmental and social governance.
Right.
A Democrat, Representative Ann Johnson, went off on him and said, this would bring the state of Texas into every boardroom. It's not conservative. And as a Democrat, I'm doing more to protect the interests of corporations than you right now. And so whereas Harrison was very firm that he had a social, you know, this was a social issue that he felt was, you know, as a conservative, everyone should be opposed to environmental and social governance because it's liberal and it often is driven by social motives instead of financial ones. It's not good to the shareholders. You know, Johnson and then the Republicans on the panel were all kind of like, this would probably screw over corporations.
Skeptical, shall we say.
Skeptical, yeah. So I think that's, and it could be also just that he's new and he maybe didn't think through the bill as his critics said. We don't know.
Well, let's listen to it. Now, that exchange came up in the context of a kind of long-running battle between between Brian Harrison and the leadership team, and in particular, the chair of that committee, Chairman Leach. So let's see if we can roll that clip.
Aspect of it. Representative Harrison, can I ask, I've been chair of this committee now four sessions. I've heard hundreds of bills. I've never had a member actively on his cell phone while he's laying out a bill and answering questions from a fellow member.
Is there a question there?
What are you, tweeting? Are you texting? He's trying to ask you questions.
I'm not
and engage
tweeting,
him.
But I thought,
hang
I thought
on,
we're supposed
let me finish.
To be...
Let me finish. Okay. He's trying to engage you in a serious discussion about this bill.
Yes.
And you're punting on his very serious questions.
That's false.
You're asking us, and I don't know what you're doing on your phone, but you're not paying attention to him.
I am paying attention.
Every time the camera goes back to him, I'm watching up here.
How
you're
I know
on
the cameras.
Phone.
I'm not paying any attention to the cameras. You're paying attention to the cameras.
I'm paying attention to you, Representative Harrison. I'm asking you to please stay off your phone while you're answering questions from Representative Dyson.
I was actually looking up information related to the questions.
So you don't have, you have to look on your phone for answers to his questions?
No. That would be a preposterous thing.
I'm asking you with respect.
Are we supposed to keep our comments?
Representative Harrison, you are sitting and laying out your bill before my committee, okay? I am asking you to stay off your cell phone while you are sitting in front of my committee laying out your bill, answering questions from Representative Dyson or any other member up here.
Should I remind you about the comments you made about the need to maintain decorum in this proceedings?
Representative Harrison, when I think about decorum, I think about a member who's laying out a bill staying off his cell phone. If you can just stay off your cell phone for just a few more minutes.
This is silly.
And answer questions from Representative Dyson and other members.
I have answered every question.
Representative Harrison, I'm asking you to stay off your cell phone.
This is ridiculous.
While you do your bill layout. Representative Dyson.
Kind of a long, painful clip, but a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, there's some interesting...
we've been talking about policy and ideology, but that's at play here, but...
Personalities.
What do you make of it?
Personalities too. And for the record, I actually was, a staffer who was sitting behind Harrison texted me and said, "Yeah, I saw him texting and checking Twitter." So yeah, cast some doubt on that answer. But
some original reporting, which we appreciate.
Thank you. Yeah. You're welcome. Real service to the public there. But first of all, Leach hadn't slept, which is kind of interesting. But I don't doubt that he would have said this totally well rested. There was a huge blow up the week before where Chairman Leach had called up Harrison's bill And Harrison wasn't there. And he, I guess, texted Harrison and said, we called up your bill, you weren't here. If you want it back on the schedule, you can tell the parliamentarian. And Harrison said, whatever, just do it next week. And then blew up, you know, Leach, a journalist, Scott Braddock, tweeted the video. Leach commented and said, I've never seen, you know, a representative not show up for bill layout and not even tell us he wasn't going to be there. And Harrison said, Leach is trying to smear me and all this stuff. So that's the context. But I think it's also that they're really, they find it very frustrating that Harrison spends a lot of time tweeting, in what case, you know, in many cases, total falsehoods about what's going on at the in the House. And I guess he had an opportunity to call him out and took it, especially with the phone. I think the phone is representative of Twitter, and that's part of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good, you know, semiotic read of what's there. You know, I thought it was an interesting, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to play it, and it really does underline what we were talking about before. I mean, Leach and Harrison are definitely in different places, mm-hmm. but, you know, look, when, if you go back, where are we? I'm having to count sessions. You know, say, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the Tea Party election and when Leach was a young member, you know, Leach was a much more, I mean, the manner that you can hear in Chairman Leach's presentation, shall we say, in that clip, in some of the stuff that we've seen recently, and that, you know, is kind of characteristic. I mean, he's not a shy, he's not an unaggressive member, say the least. And, you know, he was much more of a, you know, insurgent himself in his early periods, and now he's chairman.
Was he part of the Freedom Caucus?
I don't remember if he was a formal member of the Freedom Caucus.
He was in a photo. I mean, it's kind of interesting.
You know, probably.
Yeah, that's really.
I'd have to go back and look.
That's really interesting because, well, yeah, we'd have to check. But part of this, like, dynamic between the insurgent Republicans and the more, you know, establishment or whatever, was that people were worried that if they continue to block the local and consent calendars, that we'll have a repeat of the 2017 Mother's Day massacre, which right. was when the Freedom Caucus killed about 100 bills ahead of a deadline by refusing to let the local and consent calendar pass. And I just was seeing a Texas Tribune
article. That happened right before the deadline. And
yep.
Yeah. We should just add as local color, and many of our listeners will know this, but, you know, the local and consent calendar that was killed last week basically just got put on the regular calendar.
Yes.
Right. The Mother's Day massacre, as the date suggests, they killed a bunch of bills right before a deadline that meant those bills were dead.
Yeah. Yeah. This time.
Yeah.
But there's still a fear that if they continue to do that, there's no way they'll catch up.
Right.
But or simply, you know, that they're sort of showing, flexing their strength, saying we can do something like this. Anyway, Leach was in a picture that was of one of the articles about that. And so I was like, whoa, I didn't, maybe about a press conference that they gave. Anyway.
Right. And that was, you know, at the kind of the height of the resistance to Joe Strauss.
Yeah.
Right?
And so to say inter-party.
I think that was the last Strauss session that all happened.
Yeah. Obviously, inter-party tension in Texas for the GOP is not at all foreign, not new.
Right.
But I've also heard people say that this does feel new. It feels like this hardline group is more coordinated than even the Freedom Caucus, and it feels like they're more sophisticated.
Well, yeah, there's been some learning that's gone on, and they're bigger.
They're bigger. Yep. Right. There's about at least 13 members, sometimes as many as 20, depending on.
Yeah. And you know, and bigger makes a difference.
Yeah.
Right. I think they're, and I think it's, you know, whoever you, I mean, I think that observation is a good one, that they've learned more.
Yeah.
Right. You know, we could even maybe talk about the quality of some of the people in there. Okay. So let's widen the lens a little bit here and listen to another clip of another sort of expression of this recently. And this is from just later in the day yesterday. It's funny, when you got here, you were saying this week has seemed a little quieter. I was thinking that this week has been a little you know, a little noisier, but, you know, that's all pretty subjective. So to set this up, this is an excerpt from a floor debate in the House, again, yesterday on Wednesday of this week on HB 366. I got this bill number right, which is Dade Phelan's bill that would call for labeling of AI-generated fake video and images in campaign ads, broadly speaking. Had a few other provisions, but that's the core of it. Now, this is from an exchange, not coincidentally, as we can unpack on the other side, between the bill author, former Speaker Dade Phelan, making what has been for this session a rare appearance at the front mic, who I think we hear first in this, and from Mitch Little, freshman, who also, as it turned out, was one of Ken Paxton's lawyers in the Senate impeachment trial, which Representative Little is sort of rode the prominence from that into a seat in the House.
Yeah, by unseating an incumbent who he painted as less conservative. So again, that divide there.
It fits into the, yes, fits into the discussion we've been having. Good addition. All right, let's roll that clip.
You know, images are very powerful. Quite often they don't even, people don't even bother to read the verbiage or what's on paper or even what's on screen. The images are more powerful than the words.
Speaker Phelan, I agree they're very powerful. I had images that you paid for sent into my district of me between Joe Biden and Beto O'Rourke. And the question is, why is it okay for you to do it and it's not okay for the people out there to do it? Makes sense about that?
I don't know what was sent in your district. I just know what was sent in my district. And I know it was sent in other people's district. And it shouldn't be right. This is the beginning, I think, of a new era in ethics where the voters need to know what is real and what is not. This AI technology gets better every single day. It gets more inexpensive, more reasonably every single day. It's going to become the norm. And quite frankly, my voters, again, if they can't tell that my opponent was endorsed by Donald Trump, which is a very valuable endorsement in our primary politics, when they don't even believe that, you know, that's pretty eye-opening.
Speaker Phelan, it seems like you want a new era because you found out that when you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Well, I didn't die by the sword.
So, lots to unpack there. I mean, just to, you know, again, for somebody, most people will know this, but that live by the sword, die by the sword has to do with the fact that, you know, you mentioned Tim Dunn earlier and, you know, the Phelan's opponents brought a lot of money to bear to try to beat him in the primary. He barely escaped that primary, but didn't escape with the speakership.
Yep.
And so that's really kind of, and you also hear that smattering of hooting and applause in response is, I think really illustrates the more emotive level, if you will, of the kind of things we're talking about here.
Well, and a lot of Democrats were clapping. I mean, some of them at least. And
well, Joe Moody was standing behind him clapping.
Yeah. That's really interesting too. And Democrats then voted, I think every Democrat voted in favor of Phelan's bill, which we should note would give up to a year in prison, in jail for violating it, for not disclosing when you use deep fakes or anything like that. It's not true. There's been a lot of the kind of the grassroots Twitter people saying it bans political memes. It does not. It's simply if you're a candidate or a PAC and you pay for an AI fake thing, you have to disclose it's fake and disclose it's a political ad.
Yeah, I would also urge, you know, just in the interest of, you know, good public education, a lot of those issues came up, I mean, in that debate on the floor, came up in committee, but was raised by a lot of the opponents of the bill. You know, you can find that on the internet, in the House archive, and I think this clip is also, it might be on the Texas Impact site too. So I would urge people to go and look at the broader debate, given all that. But one of the reasons I thought that fit into this discussion is because both Phelan and Little are convenient stand-ins for this kind of insider-outsider conflict that I think is also underlying this division.
You know, and that brings up another thing. When we are talking about sort of the spectrum on which this division exists, part of it is also explained by the impeachment last year. And so Little and Phelan, Little versus Phelan, you don't get, you know, more symbolic than that of the impeachment. So a lot of the primary challenges, including the challenge against Phelan, were the challengers talked a lot about how the fake Republicans, rhinos, whatever you want to call them, voted to impeach the most conservative attorney general Texas has ever seen. And so that also has absolutely remained when you see where people split. It's, you know, some of the Republicans who are newer and, you know, weren't here to vote to impeach Phelan or didn't vote to impeach, or, sorry, to impeach Paxton. And some of the ones who did vote to impeach Paxton based on, you know, send him to a Senate trial based on the evidence that they saw.
And that conflict, you know, it just kind of, or the conflict over the attorney general pops up in all of these places. I mean, you were mentioning when we were talking about the abortion debate, the enforcement powers given to the attorney general.
Yep. And then the Senate is definitely more in favor. I mean, the Senate has a closer relationship with him because they voted to acquit him. Paxton has remained pretty frustrated with most of the House who voted to impeach him.
I think frustrated probably is a kind word. You know, as someone said about me not that long ago, kind of sarcastic, gift for understatement. what else are you following right now that interests you before we shift gear and close out a little bit?
Well, I'm following kind of how the Democrats are thinking about their power and the ways they can use it this session. Again, they're still outnumbered, but they were trying to block some successfully delayed a few constitutional amendments that Republicans want to pass related to property taxes and exemptions for that generally. And so they kind of cracked on that earlier this week. They had 8 Democrats go over and then a few more broke and now the dam's open. So I want to dig into sort of what happened there. But I'm also, what I'm really interested in that was something I couldn't quite get to in the other story was, and this is just interesting to me as someone who actually is new, this is my first session, is how that the Texas legislature is actually pretty different from Congress in the way that it functions and in the partisan tension that you see. So it seems like, I mean, when you're on the floor, so journalists, thankfully, still get to sit on the floor and, you know, be there with the lawmakers, which even staffers aren't allowed to do. In the Senate, we have to sit in the gallery. But what you see is you see someone like Ann Johnson or even, you know, a lot of the Democratic members patting the Republicans on the back, Christian Manuel or Venton Jones, and you see a lot of that camaraderie. You see them, they have inside jokes, they know each other's families. Democrats spoke in favor of Phelan's bill here. Christian Manuel gave a very impassioned speech about how heart-wrenching it was to see Phelan's wife face threats and Phelan face threats during that primary from people who were misinformed, he felt, about what was going on. And there's a lot of bills that are Democrats, Republicans are co-signed on, primarily on local and consent. But, you know, that's just an interesting dynamic. They pass, I mean, right now they're passing like 100 bills a day in some of the chambers, sometimes less, sometimes more. But you can see that Congress, you look up Congress right now, they've passed 5 bills. It seems like 2 of them are actually meaty. The other ones are like urging someone to do something.
Yeah.
Kind of like, so.
More like resolutions.
One is Senator Ted Cruz's Take It Down Act, also about deepfakes. I don't remember what the other one was. But anyway, the Texas House moves, it works so differently. So what I saw when I wrote this article was that there was this really pretty strong frustration, especially from Democrats, but from others as well, of like, we don't have time to be dysfunctional like Congress is. We want to go home at the end of, you know, at the end of May and go back to our jobs. They're paid $72,000 a year.
$7,200.
Yes, you're correct. Yeah. $7,200. Yeah. They have a per diem.
I think some of them would kill for $72,000 at this
point. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have to be independently wealthy generally or have some other, or you can just have another job, but it's hard to keep
something
up.
That you can put on autopilot while you're.
Yeah. You know. So anyway, I just thought that was really interesting. I think it's something that not everyone realizes about the Texas legislature. They come out with some really, really partisan laws. You know, everyone, and this is what, you know, one Democrat said to me, everyone goes back in their partisan corners when we have big legislation. We vote, you know, based on our party. But in between, there's actually a lot of camaraderie and working together that goes on. So,
yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting, I mean, I'll be interested to see how what the reporting yields on this. I mean, because I think that's, you know, look, I, by the way that you pose that, undeniably accurate. I mean, they get more done when they're here. They're kind of forced to, in a way, by the constitutional design. But there's also a kind of interesting nostalgia, I think, around people's views that, you know, the Texas legislature is just very different than the national legislature. We don't want to be like Congress. We don't want to be like Washington, D.C. But the, you know, there's a certain amount of idealization that goes on there that that fascinates me, right? Because on one hand, as I say, clearly there's something accurate about the two characterizations of the two chambers and where they are right now. But that hasn't really prevented the output of the legislature, particularly in the last 20 years, from being clearly indicative of who's in charge.
Yep.
Right. And if you go back to when people were, you know, the high point of this nostalgia when you, and I, this will almost certainly come up to, when you talk to people, I suspect, you know, was kind of the interim between the shift from Democratic one-party rule to Republican one-party rule. So when people talk about the golden age of Texas politics, they're talking about George W. Bush in the governorship as a Republican, Pete Laney as a Democratic Speaker of the House, Bob Bullock as a conservative Democrat, not unlike Laney, running the Senate. And I think what it really underlines is that, you know, the consistency across all of that is that you govern Texas from the center right.
Yeah.
Even when Democrats were running the place.
Yeah.
Right. And so unpacking all of that in terms of how people, the debates that are going on now, I think is very difficult. And I think it's one of the things that's really interesting about people listen to the podcast have kind of gone on about this a little, but. You know, there's an argument that's going on among the borough's opponents right now, which is taking place under the mantle of reform.
Yeah.
They're not saying we want a stronger, more parliamentary style system where the majority party gets what they want and the minority party shuts up and waits their turn. Right. They're saying we want this to run differently in a more transparent, more consistently in a way that is more consistent with who owns the majority.
Yep.
And it's almost like abandoning that nostalgic vision.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting animating force in this discussion, particularly given the design of constitutional government in Texas. I mean, it's not an accident that the legislature only meets for 140 days every other year, and that, as you were, you know, noting, and that the legislators don't get paid very much. They're not supposed to be, in the classic conception, professional politicians. All of these things are intended for the legislature to do very little.
Yep.
And the argument being made by the reformers in many ways, and you kind of bumped up against this earlier, is that, you know, one of the things that's wrong about the way that needs to be reformed is that the House does not move decisively and does not pass enough of the good stuff. Mm-hmm. Legislature is designed to pass as little as possible and to do as little as
possible. Which is a conservative thing in and of itself.
So there's an interesting kind of tension there in this discussion that's going on.
Yeah, and there's a debate among Democrats whether they should be pushing back more, whether they should be also more partisan in the way that they reject, you know— some Democrats really wanted to keep blocking those constitutional amendments until they got more concessions. So there's like a debate between sort of the progressive Democrats and the more, I guess, pragmatic, maybe more less progressive Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats have their own kind of there's the same kind of issue that we were talking about earlier with Republicans with Democrats, is that sometimes there's a reinforcing cleavage between cooperation versus conflict and moderation versus more progressive.
Yes.
But not always.
Yeah.
because, you know, I would argue that some of the Democrats that have learned how to work with leadership and work around it are
very progressive.
Are very progressive Democrats. I mean, in terms of just pure ideology.
Yeah.
You know, but those are the kinds of things that you wind up. You know, they're difficult to unpack, and I think they're difficult to unpack for a public audience.
Yeah.
You and I can sit here and split hairs about this, you know, because we're, you know, looking at clips that both of us have already seen because we were watching them. That's not what your readership is necessarily doing, which is a clumsy transition point, which is, let's talk a little bit about your job for just a few minutes. So, Statesman was recently sold by Gannett to the Hearst Papers. Can you tell the difference?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
So, Gannett has a very different model from Hearst. It's much bigger, and its business model tends to be basically making newspapers as lean as possible, cutting staff, selling a lot of advertising, and in a lot of cases, the papers they buy, like, you know, Corpus, well, some of the papers they buy just becomes essentially ghost papers where they're running USA Today content that's national, and they have maybe one reporter. Hearst has sort of said, we think that we want to focus on, you know, investing in the newsroom, having more reporters there, being really ambitious about the reporting we do. Also, their portfolio is larger. Hearst owns like ESPN and some other sites, so they don't make all their money on newspapers. And so they've said they'll invest more. We'll see how that goes. But so far, I mean, we're getting our first raise in like, I don't think under Gannett we had any raises, like this is going to be the whole newsroom gets a raise in around May, and there's annual raises at Hearst. Gannett,
not so much.
Never did that, and they especially said we're not even giving individual raises while we were negotiating, while the union was negotiating a contract. So that's one way you can see it. They're, even this, the way their website is designed is different. They have. Our website right now has a lot of videos and a lot of ads. Their websites are a little more, you know, it's subscriber only, but there are fewer ads.
So we've talked about, so you talked about the difference in the corporate ownership. You know, I want to turn it a little bit. You know, the Statesman, and it's funny as I was kind of thinking about how I wanted to ask you this and how I was laughing at myself at how anachronistic this seems, but the Statesman is like the hometown daily for the Ledge. Which feels a little odd to even say in this media environment anymore, but or not. Does that matter in the current media environment? Do you think of yourself as working for the hometown paper?
Of the Ledge?
Yeah.
No, it feels really more like our audience are, you know, is the people who live in Austin. Some of them definitely work for the Ledge or are involved. But it doesn't... I mean, we've seen the stats. It's not like every single office has a Statesman subscription.
Yeah.
I would say the Tribune has sort of moved a little bit into that role where, you know, they have a really solid audience of lobbyists and the lawmakers. They have events that have the lawmakers there. They have an insider newsletter. And so they tend to have a bigger base of people that follow that. And they tend to write about a little more inside baseball stuff than we do.
That's perfect. I mean, that's interesting. Like, I was wondering about how you parse that. So, like, what are your expectations of your readers? I mean, to go back to kind of how I set this up. I mean, we're talking about very interior stuff, and I think it's interesting to read in the Statesman now because I think this kind of coverage has not been as prominent under Gannett. You know, pretty nuanced coverage. I mean, some of your colleagues are writing very nuanced coverage of this. But what are your expectations? I mean, do you expect your readers to understand that? How much of it you feel a pretty strong burden to explain this stuff?
Very strong burden to explain. Well, and it's also like how I see them as like, I see every story as like, will this impact my readers in a material way where they can understand what this means? The local and consent calendar is actually a pretty concrete impact. One of the bills, again, about deer overpopulation, that's if those bills are delay, then you can see the impact of that. And also you can see the impact of how it impacts how the House operates in general, which impacts how much how many laws get passed, which impacts how many laws from Democrats get passed. Obviously, Austin has Democrats, all that stuff. So I tend to ask that question. I think every reporter, you try to, I mean, I've written about SB 2880 and SB 31. I wrote about those two abortion law bills many times. And each time I re-summarize what's in it, because you just don't, you can never, especially in the digital age, you cannot assume someone's read the print edition 2 weeks ago when you also kind of explain the whole bill.
Right.
But you also, you know, you structure the story so the new stuff's at the top. It's a hard question. It's one I'm still learning, but generally because I myself am sort of new to the ledge, you know, if I think that, like, I feel like I have a better perspective on what matters to someone who isn't a total insider.
You're also on the, this is an old guy question. You're on the young side, really, your generation of the Capitol Press Corps, you know, per your explanation a moment ago. There's still a lot of the kind of veterans going there. Do you think there's a significant difference between how the younger cohort, call them generation, if you will, views covering the ledge and politics in Texas, and how the older generations of reporters approach it? And what I have in mind to some degree, and look, everybody's had to adjust to this, is, you know, how integrated social media is as part of the game. I mean, and that's not just the game of coverage. I mean, we just saw a clip in which obviously Leach was leaning on Brian Harrison for his, you know, kind of Twitter-driven persona and his use of Twitter. You know, I'm reminded Abby Livingston, who used to cover DC politics for the Tribune, is now at Puck, was on one of the Puck podcasts a few months ago. And, you know, and it's kind of a side point, made this distinction between members who are elected and then go and understand their job is to legislate and represent, and members who are elected who feel like their job is to go and build a social media following and convey their positions and their brand on Twitter.
Yep.
You know, there's, I think it's gotten a little less prominent recently since Twitter became X and social media is fragmented, but there's definitely a kind of generational divide in how people view all that. I mean, but is there, I mean, do you see a difference?
Interestingly, I'd say on social media, you don't have as much of that divide. I mean, some of the more veteran reporters, like Scott Braddock, for example, I mean, no one tweets more than Scott Braddock. He's built, like, he has like 50,000 followers or something. And Jeremy Wallace at the Houston Chronicle, they have really, you know, he likes to tweet. He makes TikToks. I should get on Jeremy Wallace's level. And he's like, I don't know how old he is, but he's definitely probably twice my age, maybe. Maybe a little less.
Don't oh, he's pretty
Jeremy,
old.
If you're listening to this. But
I'm just hoping that gets back to him.
Yeah, good. Yeah, excellent. I don't think social media is really the divide. One thing I see is that the younger reporters, like, well, especially the Tribune, I've also found myself interested in this, you know, have a close eye on who's on the Christian nationalism thing a little bit more, whereas, like, maybe the older reporters are more focused on sort of the day-to-day. And I mean, my colleague John Moritz, he's a really great reporter. He's very good at also making, you know, the dynamics of what goes on very accessible to readers. I don't see a huge difference, I guess, is what I'd say. I really actually don't. I think we all work together really well. We're all good friends. I learned so much from John.
And y'all spend a lot of time together.
Yeah.
Right? Especially during session.
Oh, yeah. So I haven't really seen a huge divide in that sense.
No, that's a good answer.
And overall, it's a pretty young press corps when you think about it.
Yeah, it's a little younger now, I think, than it's been in a while. You know, we're in one of those phases that kind of, you know. Anything else I should have asked you that I didn't? I love asking reporters that.
Yeah, it's our question. I guess one other, I do think, like, we tend to write more about social media dynamics than maybe the older generation of reporters. Like, Kayla Harris, who's now at the Baltimore Banner, wrote a story about the meme groups that are, like, animate the ledge during Twitter, on Twitter. But anyway, no, I don't think there's anything else. I think we've covered a lot of ground. So.
Okay, well, I use that answer too with reporters. So perfect. Makes me feel like I maybe know what I'm doing. Bayless, thanks so much for being here. I hope you'll come back another time.
Thanks so much, Jim. I had a great time.
Good. Bayless Wagner of the Austin American Statesman. You can read her story. She writes a lot. She's prolific. She's a good worker. At the Austin American Statesman, that's statesman.com. I want to thank her again. Thank our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts here at UT Austin. Some of the data that we'll talk about, you'll find at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Keep an eye out. We'll have new data soon. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.